Welcome to the Science Show on Cambridge 105.
We're told that the climate will change in the long term, but can we believe that when we can't even predict tomorrow's weather? Our guest is a professor in climate physics, and he'll be reminding us that actually we're quite good at predicting tomorrow's weather. And he'll also tell us what the job entails and how maths and physics are at the core of them making these predictions. That's coming up after this little bit of a tune. This is the Science Show on Cambridge 105, the community radio in your city. We start with a hello from me, Roger Frost.
And a hello from me, Chris Creese.
And now to the topic of climate change, and more exactly the task of predicting climate change, though I wonder is exactly the right word here. In a past show, we heard how drilling in the Antarctic produces cylinders or cores of ice, which are then analysed layer by layer to learn how our climate varied through the ages. Now, these ice cores also give us perspective on the climate that we might expect in the future.
That's right, but today's guest draws on different evidence. This evidence comes from measurements collected from weather satellites in the sky. Tim Palmer is a professor of climate physics at the University of Oxford and president of the Royal Meteorological Society.
Yep, and I caught up with Professor Palmer when he made a lightning visit to town to talk to physicists at Cambridge University. And his specialism is, as you said, in using satellite data to predict the weather and climate. And it's an area where people not only make predictions, but they also predict the certainty of their predictions.
Sounds like a lot of maths and physics.
Yes, it is. It is a lot of maths and physics. But we're actually going to be hearing now more about how climate scientists actually work.
Mm-hmm. That's great. So let's have a listen to this 10-minute chat about the work of a climate physicist.
I'm a climate physicist. I work at University of Oxford, but I collaborate very much with the main groups around the world and in the UK and Europe that are developing our large-scale climate models. So I'm very much somebody who's involved in computational models, trying to represent the very complex climate system that we live in inside a computer and using mathematics.
Okay. Does that mean you don't actually measure things?
I personally don't measure anything. I have to rely on people that do measure things, or increasingly these days, I have to rely on satellites up in space which measure things. Most of the measurements that are made these days are actually remotely sensed measurements from satellites that orbit the Earth.
Okay, and you can pick up that data.
And I can pick up the data. And of course, it's crucial when we are testing the fidelity of our climate models as to whether they can, you know, simulate the real world. So we need observations in order to test how good the models are.
Your talk today makes a comparison between weather and climate. I mean, just start us off. What's the difference between weather and climate?
The difference between weather and climate is actually remarkably difficult to define precisely. I mean, broadly speaking, weather is what we get from day to day. Today's weather is rainy, tomorrow's weather is, you know, sunny, the next day will be windy. We tend to think of weather as instantaneous, if you like, states of the atmosphere, whereas climate is more about the average statistics. You know, what's the average temperature over 30 years of winters, or how much rain falls on average in the UK during the summer. So broadly speaking, weather is sort of instantaneous states. Climate is more about statistics. Having said that, it's actually quite difficult to come up with a precise definition that would satisfy the most pernickety statistician.
Now, I think your thesis, if that's the word for it, is that if we have difficulty predicting weather in the short term, what could we say about changes in climate in the long term?
Well, it's a question that I'm often asked, and you know, people that want to rile me will often say this. So, well, you guys are useless. You can't even predict tomorrow's weather. You know, why should I possibly ever trust what you say about the next century? My answer to that is twofold. First of all, actually, to remind them that weather prediction actually is quite good these days, and it's rare that the weather is completely misforecast for the next day or so. And partly, incidentally, that's because we do have much better satellite observations of the weather than we had back in the old days when we had to rely on weather ships in the Atlantic and that sort of thing. However, the second point, which is the more important point, is that there really is a fundamental difference between weather prediction and climate prediction. And basically, weather prediction is what a mathematician would call an initial value problem, which is to say, given the observations for the weather today, can I predict ahead, forward, for tomorrow, the next day, as to the detailed evolution of weather? Tomorrow will be rainy, the next day will be sunny, the next day will be rainy again. Whereas climate is more about how the statistics of weather are expected to change as, for example, the level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere increases, as it will do in the coming century. So it's what would be, again, mathematically called a forced problem rather than an initial value problem. We specify the forcing is the fact that we are increasing carbon dioxide year upon year. Just to give you an analogy, imagine today is the 21st of December, which I know it isn't, but it would be the winter solstice. If you ask me to predict exactly what the weather will be, say, on the 21st of June, that's 6 months ahead, I couldn't really tell you whether it was going to be a dry day or a wet day or a cloudy day or a clear day. So it would be very difficult, if not impossible, to predict precisely the weather. But in a statistical sense, I can tell you, because the sun will be that much higher in the sky in June rather than December, I can tell you statistically it's likely to be much warmer. Statistically, it's likely to be drier. Statistically, it's going to be summer rather than winter. So the equivalent there is the fact that in the summer the sun is much higher in the sky and provides more of a forcing. So it's similarly with climate change. We're systematically changing the composition of the atmosphere by our burning of fossil fuels. And, you know, like trying to predict the transition from winter to summer, we're trying to predict the transition from pre-industrial CO2 to 21st century CO2.
Surely you're predicting, you just need to tell us there's a problem. We don't need the fine-grained detail, or do we?
So there are different issues here. In trying to alert society and politicians in particular to the risks of severe and potentially catastrophic changes to climate, we don't need detailed predictions. It's enough, in a way, to know that what we're doing has a substantial probability of making changes to climate that can be very largely undesirable to most of humanity. So we don't need detailed levels of fine resolution predictions for that reason. However, it is almost certain that even if by some small miracle the politicians actually do agree to dramatic emissions cuts in greenhouse gases, Even with that, we still will be facing climate change of some description. It's a question of whether it'll be bad or catastrophic. If it's just bad, then we still have to try to adapt to what these changes in climate will be. And it's not just about changes in temperature. It's about changes in, most importantly, actually, in rainfall patterns. I mean, changes in rainfall patterns affects all sorts of things, from agriculture, health, just generally the environment. And we need to make decisions in regions which might be more prone to drought. They will perhaps have to build more reservoirs. In other areas, we'll have to invest more in flood defences. So the issue of adaptation involves spending large amounts, you know, multi-billion pound infrastructure to adapt to climate change. And then we really do need to know at the detailed regional level what these climate changes are going to be. And that's where these high-resolution, detailed and accurate climate models are going to be essential to be able to really advise government, business, society, everything about what we're going to expect and what we can do to try to adapt to it. I should say one more thing, incidentally. A thing that's creeping up above the horizon is the possibility that if we can't agree to any substantial reductions in greenhouse gas emissions, then there is a kind of a plan B, which most people hate the idea of, but it's the idea that we could do something to geoengineer climate, as it's called, to change climate in such a way as to offset this greenhouse gas warming. Mm-hmm. An example of this is the idea of spraying small droplets of what's called sulfate aerosol, essentially sulfuric acid, actually, up in the stratosphere, which is going to put a hazy layer up there, which will reflect sunlight back to space, and that will partly offset the warming. Now, this has been proposed, but the really big problem with this are the unintended consequences. We don't really know what these types of potential solutions will do, for example, to the monsoons in the world or to the natural patterns of rainfall. We may make some major areas that are currently quite equable into permanent drought. We just don't know. So again, we would need these very high resolution detailed climate models to be able to be confident that we weren't really going to mess up the climate system with one of these geoengineering solutions.
Just thinking about, as somebody who's coming into this area as a career option, what does work look like?
For me, one of the most enjoyable aspects of work is it's extremely collaborative. Some areas of science, you kind of lock yourself away in your office and you write papers, and only when you write papers do you actually start talking to other people. Well, this is not the way it works in climate science, and it can't do really, because it requires people to share information, to share data, to share computer models. I mean, I have a group of, I don't know, say a dozen or so people in Oxford, but we are interacting on a daily basis with groups literally around the world, and we do this work collaboratively. So I myself am not out there taking observations, I'm developing models, but it's work that we do with groups all over the world. So it's very international, it's very collaborative, and it enables me to apply the kind of mathematical training I got as a physicist, and in fact a theoretical physicist, to apply some quite sophisticated mathematical thinking to a problem that is really manifestly important societally. I mean, it's hard to think perhaps of anything that has even, as much impact as this. So it's important, very collaborative, but uses hard science. The basis of my work are the basic laws of physics, Newton's laws of motion, the laws of thermodynamics, the laws of quantum mechanics, all this stuff. These are the things that go into the models. So, it's great. It's an application of basic physics, basic mathematics, but into an arena which has enormous societal importance.
Can I just throw in one indulgent question I want to ask a meteorologist, which is, what's your favourite temperature? You could have, what's your favourite unit?
To answer your question in two ways, I think the number is zero. And the reason I say that is pretty much one of the first times I went to the United States, I switched on the TV in the morning in my hotel room, and the guy says, oh, temperature's going to be around zero today, a little chilly. I thought, well, yeah, zero's a little chilly, but it's not too bad. I've experienced that before. So I put on a jumper, but not too much, went outside, and I have never experienced such a feeling in my life as the winds howled through my... And I realised at that moment, of course, he meant zero Fahrenheit, not zero Celsius. So zero is my favourite number, because it really makes a difference which units you're talking about. It really does make a difference.
A sharp reminder there. Well, thank you very much there, Tim.
OK, that was Professor Tim Palmer of Oxford University talking with me, Roger Frost, during his visit to Cambridge. The show podcast page will have some links to some of the research that we've been talking about.
And we'll also pop up a link to a report by the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Did you get that, Roger?
Mm-hmm.
It shows a consensus in the scientific community on some pretty sobering facts.
Oh, sobering facts. I like them.
There's strong confidence that the amount of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere has increased to levels unprecedented over the last 800,000 years.
Wow.
And this increase in carbon dioxide is primarily from the burning of fossil fuels since the Industrial Revolution. So that's happened quite quickly. And because our oceans have absorbed about a third of this excess CO2, the waters are turning acidic.
Yikes.
Yes.
So it's good to know that researchers like Tim Palmer are on the case. And it would really be good to hear consensus on what solutions are in order today.
Yeah, well, reducing our waste, energy consumption and carbon footprints, I think, would be a good start. So, hey, maybe we should walk home today, Roger.
Maybe we should walk home. Yep, we should. I might put on my walking shoes, or it might be in your dreams, Chris.
You're listening to The Science Show on Cambridge 105.
That's pretty much all for today's Science Show on Cambridge 105.
You can now pick up our podcasts on iTunes. Just search for 105 Science.
And if you want a reminder of that, please follow us on Twitter at 105 Science.
And that leaves us to say many thanks to Professor Tim Palmer of Oxford University. So I'll say bye from me, Chris Creese.
And it's bye from me, Roger Frost.